I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Today we discuss the Iraqis who were killed, threatened, or tortured for working with the U.S. government to rebuild Iraq. In studio, Beth Murphy, director, producer, and founder of Principal Pictures, whose documentary film The List focuses on the efforts of American Kirk Johnson, who's been fighting to save Iraqis' lives who are in danger because they worked for the U.S. government and military to help rebuild Iraq. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Kirk Johnson joins us on the phone from Los Angeles. He's the author of To Be a Friend is Fatal, The Fight to Save the Iraqis America Left Behind. Good morning to you, Kirk.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Let's listen to the trailer for the film just to get an idea of the story.
I'm tired of hiding. I'm tired of running away. This shouldn't have happened to me or to the majority of Iraqi people running away from their country.
There was an implicit bargain. You come to work with us, we'll take care of you. You run these risks for us, we'll watch out for you.
We were very proud. We were showing out our badges. Look, we are working with Americans. It's very good work. They are very nice people.
These are Iraqis who sat with Americans and helped us try to rebuild Iraq.
I was told that your future will be safe with us. We will be protected. And we discovered that actually that wasn't the whole truth.
These Iraqis are not dying for Iraq. They're dying because they're coming to work for our country. They're dying for America.
Day after day, we start to hear about people being slaughtered and being abducted for working for the U.S. government.
A young American named Kirk Johnson, who served in USAID in Fallujah, has taken it upon himself to find every Iraqi who has worked for USAID.
There's 1,000 names sitting in front of you right now. And of the 1,000 names, only 40 have been processed. Could you explain that?
How many more Iraqis are going to have to die until they respond to this?
In the first days, we didn't feel that this list was leading anywhere. But this list is actually something, and more people are taking it seriously.
Great to see you too.
I've been doing this for a year, and we've gotten around 30 people in.
Tens of thousands need the same help.
My concern is if the American troops go out this country, what will happen for somebody like me?
You know, something I remember that I really like, it's a quote from Mother Teresa. You know what she said? She said, the opposite of love is not hate, but indifference.
That's a really powerful quote, Beth. The opposite of love is not hate, it's indifference.
It is, and it really resonates here and continues to resonate. You know, when we spoke to him later and he had arrived in America, he was in the back of a taxi with Kirk coming home from the airport in New York. And he said, you know, what are the Americans thinking? They come here and they work with us and they make promises and they say they want to help us, but then they leave. And that's it. And there's nothing. There's nothing. I mean, no one will come to work for America again. Don't they realize that? And I think that's the thing that was and continues to be so astonishing for Iraqis and also for Afghans who have worked with the United States, that indifference that you've used us. Now we're in danger for helping you. Don't you want to help us?
Yeah. And Kirk, this is a story that a lot of people, Americans, don't know about. I mean, they, you know, thought we took down Saddam Hussein, we helped with rebuilding, and then all is supposed to be well. This is a story that a lot of Americans still to this day, I think, probably are not aware of.
Yeah, you know, it's not for a lack of effort on a lot of people's part, but I think, you know, the Iraq War never really asked much of this country. Our leaders never really asked the country to be that much involved, and so I mean, I'm somewhat cynical, but I think that for the most part, Americans kind of checked out, you know, by 2004 thereabouts, and so these sort of ongoing intractable problems, they don't really pierce through the American sort of psyche and make this you know, but there have been tons of you know, articles and reports about this over the years, and it comes in, you know, waves, whether it's Iraq or Afghanistan, but it it hasn't become sort of as known as I think it should.
Right. We're going to say we'll be showing the film February 2nd at the Wellfleet Harbor Actors Theater, and we'll have more information on that later in the hour. Let's backtrack a little bit here, Kirk. Just talk about your background. You grew up in the suburbs of Chicago, and in some ways, the story begins with your grandmother, who was a role model. She, too, did her best to help refugees. Tell us a little bit about her and your experience growing up.
Well, I had this amazing grandmother who... she never went to college, but she thought that travel was the best form of education, and so she went all throughout the world. She brought a lot of the world to herself, and I mean, you mentioned the refugee thing, but when I was growing up, there were, I think she opened her home up to about 20 Laotian refugees over the course of a decade or so, But the story also really begins when she brought me to Egypt when I was 15 years old, and it just completely changed my life because I was completely, captivated by the country and by the language, and that's when I started studying Arabic shortly after my return when I was 16 years old.
Yeah, so you got back, you applied to study Arabic, and then after you graduated, you went back to Egypt, and you ended up interning at the New York Times Middle East Bureau. Tell us how you ended up working for the government in Baghdad.
So I was doing a Fulbright scholarship in Egypt during the invasion, and I had been very much opposed to the war, but that scholarship is federally funded. I saw it as a gift that my country had given me. And rather than return to sort of the ivory tower, I felt that I ought to try to go pitch in and right a wrong that, I kept reading that the government needed people who spoke Arabic. And by that point, I had roughly 7 years of Arabic under my belt. And so I applied to go work on the reconstruction of Iraq, which I completely supported, even though I hadn't supported the invasion. I felt that, of course, I should go try to help with that. And so I was 24 when I went over to work with the U.S. Agency for International Development, first in Baghdad and then in Fallujah.
Yeah, and you worked alongside Iraqis who wanted to help rebuild their country. Seemed like a great idea at the time, but this becomes a nightmare. And what I thought was interesting in the book is this sort of prejudice that existed. As you're going through the training, some of the things I'm reading, I'm thinking, wow, this just doesn't seem right.
Yeah, I think it sort of fails the basic sort of gut decency test when you sit in those rooms and go through the training. I mean, the thing that you're alluding to, which I wrote about in the book, in one of the orientation briefings for newly arriving Americans, the executive officer, who's sort of the number three in command at USAID in Baghdad, she was asked the question, there's so many Iraqis working here. How do we keep, how do we memorize all of their names? And, what do you do with that? And she kind of, brushed her hand through the air, and she said, "Oh, I just call him Ahmed or Mohammed. That does the trick." And these Iraqis, I mean, I actually went through our list. We had, I think, there were only two Iraqis named Ahmed. But the reason why I mention it is because I think that there was a general sentiment that these Iraqis were, expendable, they were cheap labor, they were third-class citizens in our compound.
Beth, how did you learn of what was happening in Iraq and Kirk's efforts to help? Where did you come in the story?
Yeah, it was the spring of 2007, and I was and still am serving on the board of the International Institute of New England, which is an organization based in Boston that works on refugee and immigrant issues. And at the time, we were hearing that there was going to be a large influx of Iraqis coming. And the organization, which does resettlement, the resettlement department in particular, was really gearing up for this influx and preparing to get a large number of arrivals, thinking about, where to go for, to settle apartments for people. And then nothing really happened. And it was just really at that time that some of the first reports were coming out about this very unique population. You know, the Iraq War created the largest, at the time, you know, refugee crisis in the world. And there were 5 million people displaced by the war. And within that, you know, 5 million enormous population that felt too daunting to really think, you know, how can you solve that problem? There's this very unique group, the U.S. affiliated Iraqis, and something really could be done for them and should be done for them. And so first reports coming out, but then no one arrived in Boston. There really wasn't even a trickle. I mean, it wasn't, you know, there was, so that just raised a red flag for me. And I was curious why, you know, what happened. There was this discrepancy between what was being said and then what was actually happening. So I made some phone calls, and it was actually somebody at the State Department who said, based on the questions you're asking and the information that you would like to have, I would recommend that you talk to Kirk Johnson. I just ask that if you talk with him and you do any reporting from what you talk about, that you be fair.
Mm, interesting.
And by fair, they meant, you know, be fair to us, be fair to the State Department. Mm.
All right. Kirk, talk about life inside the green zone versus outside.
It's sometimes difficult to describe because it's just so strange. You know, I had, before going to Iraq, I had lived in Egypt a couple times. I'd lived in Syria. I'd been all over the Middle East. And I got to the green zone, and I did not feel that I was in the Middle East, not in the least. I mean, it was just this very strange. So the green zone, sort of the overview, it was about 4 square miles in the heart of Baghdad with, you know, blast walls encircling it, 16-foot-tall concrete barriers. And it was just sort of clotted with the sort of nerve center of the occupation. So there would be palaces that had been converted into the embassy or the USAID compound, but then across the street would be, you know, the Bechtel compound or the KBR compound or any of the other contractors. And, you know, a lot of people would get to the green zone and they wouldn't leave for the year that they were in Iraq. They would just be within this sort of enclosure. And so life was made fairly comfortable. I mean, there were pizza parties by the pool. There was a Pizza Hut, McDonald's. There were free throw and 3-on-3 tournaments at the basketball courts behind Saddam's palace. There was Talk Like a Pirate Day. I mean, it was a very, you know, there were bars there and Iraqis that were hired on the night shift to sort of shuttle drunk Americans around between the bar and their home. You know, I had not gone to Iraq to just party. You know, I wanted to go to try to make an impact on the country. And so very quickly after arriving there, I think I started chafing against the existence there, that this can't be the right way to make a contribution in improving the situation if I'm just sitting around going to parties or something.
And then, of course, to the Iraqis who are coming into work, they're not spending the night. They have to leave. This is where other Iraqis are jotting down their names and seeing who's this is where we start to see the jeopardy that these people have put themselves in trying to help.
Exactly. You know, the Iraqis that worked for the Americans, especially the Green Zone, they were the only, that was the only part of the real Iraq that most Americans saw, were the Iraqis that were coming in from the Red Zone, which is what we called the rest of the country outside of that 4 square miles. And around each of our bases, around each of the checkpoints of the Green Zone, there were these militiamen that were posted there to take photographs of the Iraqis walking out in order to identify them for assassination, because these Iraqis were seen as traitors because they were helping us. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, they would go through incredible lengths to conceal their identity and change their routes of arriving to work each day. I mean, they were clearly risking their lives to get in to help us. And then once our workday ended, they would have to go through this gauntlet of trying to get home safely without attracting any attention from the militants.
Beth, do you want to say something?
Sure. I mean, it was just that kind of party culture that Kirk describes when we interviewed people, and they talked about just how offensive they found it. You know, there they were going back home, going through the risks that Kirk was just describing into the red zone, facing death threats. There were times when their friends were actually being killed or a family member would be kidnapped, raped, and tortured. And then they would come back to work after experiencing that hell to receive an email that says, oh, let's, you know, we're having a hoedown barbecue party tonight. Come and celebrate.
We're talking about the film The List and the book To Be a Friend is Fatal, The Fight to Save the Iraqis America Left Behind. We'll talk more after a quick break.